Hello, everyone. I'm Scott.
And hello, I am Julie.
And welcome to the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholics take a look at the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lies underneath.
That's right. Today, Something Wicked This Way Comes by the Pricking of My Thumbs, right?
That's right. Shakespeare, The Three Witches.
Yes,
right?
You bet. You
and
bet.
And by Ray Bradbury, the master.
Yep. Incredible language. Incredible language. Yeah.
Oh, I know. I was reading it and I was thinking, because I picked the book, but I haven't read it for so many years. And it way went past what I remembered, but I'd forgotten how lyrical this book is.
Yeah, absolutely it is. His writing, you know, there's so many. Well, there's not many. You know, we say a good story is hard to find. You know, a good writer is hard to find, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are just some that just have this way with language that's uniquely them.
Yes.
And Bradbury is one of those.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's nobody like him.
Even in the books that you don't expect it in, because I was reading this and I was thinking, it is so differently written than the Martian Chronicles, which is a series of loosely strung together short stories, or Fahrenheit 451, which I haven't read in even longer than this. But as I was looking through quotes by Bradbury, just in coincidence along with this, I kept coming across these things from Fahrenheit 451, which had that same kind of lyrical playing with language, but really descriptive, almost a dreamy quality, talking about books.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and he's got such a way with, he can capture the feel of an atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I think the beginning of the book is amazing.
Are you going to read that part?
Do you mind if
no,
I do?
No, please do. Yeah, go ahead.
Because
I love it. Yeah.
Okay. Just
those first two paragraphs are fantastic.
Yeah, that's... So this is the prologue, or part of the prologue. First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Not that all months aren't rare, but there be bad and good, as the pirates say. Take September, a bad month. School begins. Consider August, a good month. School hasn't begun yet. July, well, July's really fine. There's no chance in the world for school. June, no doubting it. June's best of all, for the school doors spring wide and September's a billion years away. But you take October now. School's been on a month and you're riding easier in the rains, jogging along. You got time to think of the garbage you'll dump on old man Prickett's porch or the hairy ape costume you'll wear to the YMCA the last night of the month. And if it's around October 20th and everything's smoky smelling and the sky orange and ash gray at twilight, it seems Halloween will never come in a fall of broomsticks and a soft flap of bedsheets around corners. But one strange, wild, dark, long year, Halloween came early.
Hmm. Yep. Yep, I like it.
Yeah, it took me right back to, I was never a kid in the age he's thinking of, but it took me right back to that feeling.
Yeah.
Being about 10, 11, 12. And
I grew up here in Idaho, and you know, today it's different for the kids. You know, everybody's so concerned about you know, people, strangers and stuff.
Yeah.
But when I was a kid, it was Halloween was just fantastic, and there was a certain feeling to it all the time, and going out and trick or treating and messing around and doing some things you shouldn't be doing. You know,
yeah,
like
exactly.
Little and pranks and things is what I mean, but yeah.
Yeah, that's something that's been lost. And in fact, there's somebody who's got a book called Free Range Kids who argues that that ought to come back.
Yeah, and we've had, you know, I live in a small town now, and we went away from it and back to it, which is neat. The PTO started doing a thing called Trunk or Treat, in which people just went to the elementary school and they brought candy in their cars, and mm-hmm. just got in a big line, you know, and the kids would show up in their costumes, and then in about 15 minutes, they'd have sacks full of candy.
How awful.
And it was just like a little, like an assembly line. Mm-hmm. But everybody started to feel that way about it. So last year, they didn't do it, and it went back to house, which,
mm-hmm.
and I remember walking out of my house and seeing all the kids running around on the street, and I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is it. Yeah, this is fun.
That's the thing. I can remember mm-hmm. we lived out in the country some, and my mom would drive us into town and drop us off. And she would, you know, kind of creep along in the car just because she had to keep track of where we were to pick us up. But there were hordes of kids. It was so much fun.
Yeah,
it sure is. Running around.
Yeah.
And our street will have good years and bad years. It depends on, I think, the day of the week and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get trucks full of kids from nearby apartments. And you hear people complaining about, oh, they're just, you know, in the Texas way, the Mexicans dropping the kids off. And I'm like, I don't care what kind of kids they are. They're kids. They're mm-hmm. dressed up. It's Halloween. Let's go.
Yeah.
That's part of the fun.
It is. It's all fun. It's all fun.
Yeah, and now it's been taken into a more adult setting. I think, you know, I mentioned that before, that now there's so many Halloween parties
mm-hmm.
for adults.
Yeah.
And like Hannah's friend, one of her friends who has her own apartment, is going to have a big party. And they're making a costume, and she's going to be a snowy owl.
Nice.
probably the most elegant looking snowy owl I can imagine based on cool. the description, but... Yeah, so they're all going to dress up, and they were talking about the recipe for zombies and, you know, what kind of... Yeah, so I was like, okay, it's just another social occasion for them.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Wow, well, that's neat. Yeah.
Yeah, so not anything to do with the book, of course, but it kind of does have to do with the book.
Yeah, it's the feel.
Yeah,
it's the feel of the book. Yeah, the whole thing.
And I think that guy with his free-range kid talk, I haven't read the book, but I'm in complete sympathy with, I think now... If my kids were younger, I would be, and they were older kids, I would be having them walk to school more and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as dangerous as everybody likes to make us think.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't disagree. It's hard, though, you know, when you see these news stories about these terrible things that happen, and
mm-hmm.
it's hard just to say, well, I'm going to try not to think about that and you know, let my kid go.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the opposite is bad, too. You can't just hold on to them forever. They're going to have to go out there sometime.
Right. And I think that contributes to that whole helicopter parent
uh-huh.
idea of, you know, the kids in college, their professors are being called by the parents, complaining about grades and things.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And I've heard even of supervisors at work for first jobs being called by parents.
That's astounding.
Well, it's insane, for one thing. Why put yourself to all that trouble?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. I'm just lazy enough to go, it's your deal. Move on. But yeah, isn't that? But I think part of that is learning to let your kid go and do stuff is good for the parents as well as the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it is scary because the media blows a lot of it up. I think a lot of this stuff, not as much probably, but I think the same kinds of things happened back in the day. It just wasn't spread all over the national news. So you saw 12 cases because it was from across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't see the blow by blow.
Think of To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Which is a different book.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Amanda Knox story? I know we're getting way off this topic here, but.
I don't.
Yeah. It was a murder mystery. Well, I call it a murder mystery. It wasn't to her. But she got arrested for a murder that she apparently didn't commit in Italy. But it let her go to Italy. Yeah, they let her go to Italy for...
I'm just vaguely familiar kind with of a it. Thing, she just got let out.
Right.
Right.
And that, yeah, and the only reason I'm bringing that up is just because, yeah, it's a blow-by-blow. Everybody's fascinated by this story. You know, they're making a movie about it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people think of now when they say, well, maybe you shouldn't go to Italy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
When that was one out of a million or something, yeah.
But then you see a movie like Taken.
Yeah.
Which I cannot recommend myself, mm-hmm. but
yeah, I didn't think that was a great movie. I did see it.
I was spoiler just mm-hmm. for a second. I was so annoyed with Liam Neeson for leaving all the other young girls behind
mm-hmm.
while he just went to save his daughter.
Yeah.
End of the spoiler. Sorry. Just because you shouldn't see it anyway. So there.
Yeah, it wasn't a good movie.
Yeah. But that's preying on that fear.
It sure is, yeah.
And think of how many kids go off and nothing bad happens to them.
And that's what so much of our advertising and what's going on in our country is about, too, is fear. They're tapping into that fear.
Yeah, it's the name for it in the advertising biz is fear of death. You know, the insurance commercials, that what will happen to your family when you're gone, mm-hmm. that all that stuff.
So, yeah, if they can create that fear, then they make you want something.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what's in this book.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's why Mr. Dark is so effective.
Yes. Well, so very briefly to mm-hmm. tell about the book.
Yes.
Oh, the book, that. 20 minutes in, here we
After I went to Italy and back.
Oh, well, that's okay, because I took us to soccer parks and places around the country, too. Because, like, my mom was talking to me, and she went, well, you know that Casey, what's her name, trial? When it was in Florida and she was there, she was watching every day.
Mm-hmm.
The lady who was accused of killing her baby.
Yeah, I don't remember her name, but you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because I had to visit my mom because she was sick. And so to keep my mom's spirits up, we wound up watching the trial every day.
Wow.
And I was so depressed by the end of it. But the thing is that then people think that happens all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so obsessed with it. And it's like, you know what? Don't pay so much attention to this. It's a delicate balance. Enough attention has to be paid to keep it from happening and to be alert. But, you know, on the other hand, it's not happening in every other house.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough of me about that. Okay. So basically this story, which it's been made into at least one movie, and it was actually originally written as a movie and then turned into a book, is about two boys who live next door to each other. James Nightshade and Will Halloway, and those names do mean something. They live next door to each other, and one was born just before midnight, and one was born just after midnight on Halloween, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one is dark, one is light, one has a darker nature, one has a sunnier nature, but they've always been best friends, and kind of establishes that, and then the carnival comes into town.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the night, which is unusual, and it's called Cougar and Dark's Pandemonium Shadow Show. And they live in Greentown, Illinois, so it's kind of that classic setting that Ray Bradbury loves to harken back to, is the turn-of-the-century style or early 1900s style Illinois town with the big houses and the porches and lemonade in the afternoons kind of thing.
Mm.
And they start to realize very early there's something wrong with this carnival.
Yeah, and it arrives in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like 3 a.m, I think it was.
Right.
Because that was the death hour or something.
Right, right.
And, of course, you know, one of them looks out their window at that hour and they say, oh, we got to go see this. So they jump out their windows and away they go to watch it.
And it's not mm-hmm. being set up in the way that they expect, because usually there's a lot of hoopla when a carnival comes to town to attract interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if it's doing it by itself.
Right, yeah.
And the music is odd that's being played, and then they just have this feeling something's wrong, and so does Will's father,
mm-hmm.
who is a librarian and an older father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's 54 years old, if I remember correctly. And
yeah, I guess Will and Jim are 13, going to turn 14. Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah, one of the key things about Will's dad is he's kind of a sad guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Will knows it. But it's just, you know, part of his sadness comes from that he feels he's old and he can't do some of the stuff that other fathers do. So he's 54 and has a 13-year-old kid, and, you know, he's like, I should be playing ball with him and things, and he just doesn't feel up to it.
Yeah, it's like, I'm too old to do that now.
Mm-hmm.
And he spends all his time in the library. reading books. So he's more a person of the imagination and facts than of doing. And so that's kind of the setting, really. And what happens is that a couple people start to disappear.
Yeah.
And Will and Jim are near enough to go, oh my gosh, they see it happen, or part of it, at the carnival in the middle of the night.
Yeah, exactly. And strange things start to happen, and they know in their hearts pretty much immediately that it's sinister. And
the carnival master, Mr. Dark, I guess.
Or the illustrated man, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he knows it. So kind of the carnival kind of goes on the hunt for them, because they could tell what's going on, and so they have to hide. And it's a simple story.
Yeah, it really is. It's just so poetic.
Yeah,
and I mean, there's a lot that goes on there. Mr. Dark is a cool character. He's called the Illustrated Man, which is the title of another one of Ray Bradbury's books. And it seems to me that they're two different people when I read those, you know, because the Illustrated Man is a book of short stories.
Right.
And with connecting material about the Illustrated Man, which is a man with tattoos all over him. And, you know, each tattoo is, you know, telling a story.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So here, Mr. Dark's tattoos, they writhe, and you know, when you see them, they writhe. And there's this one scene where he, and this was in the movie too, where he shows Will's dad, you know, the carnival is looking for the kids, and he shows Will's dad pictures of the kids on his palms. So he makes the tattoo on his palm, and he shows it to his dad and says, "Have you seen this guy?"
Yeah.
His dad's like, "Oh, yeah, that looks like Milton somebody. Milton Lundquist or something."
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a neat scene.
How was the movie? Was it good?
Well, I watched it just the weekend because I saw it. Yeah. So, but it is not. I would say it's not good.
Okay.
The thing is, it's a swing and a miss. There are some really memorable scenes. One of which is that one. And one of which is there's a big scene in the book that takes place in the library between Mr. Dark and the older Holloway. And that is fantastic in the movie. It's a little bit different, but it's fantastic.
Right.
But it's a swing and a miss. I mean, I remember the first thought I had when I stopped it, and the movie was made in 1983. I just couldn't help but think they're remaking Spider-Man again. But here's a movie that, with today's movie technology, would be so cool, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They could just do such a great job with this, and I would love to see them do it again.
Oh, yeah, because the carousel is a main feature. There's the Dust Witch with her big hot air balloon.
Yeah. Who's really not in the movie. She's not called the Dust Witch. She's different in the movie, but I can understand why they did what they did. You know, doing some of the effects that they were in the book was probably out of reach for them at that time. So, but now it's not. Now it would be, you know, a completely different experience, and they could really do something amazing with this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd like to see that.
Of course, it is a fairly simple story, so...
Yeah, and it is.
They might have trouble stretching it out, actually.
Well, it's actually, because it's simple, I mean, this is a two-hour movie.
Okay.
I really think that they wouldn't have to cut anything.
Okay.
That's my opinion, anyway. But,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, if we get into some of the deeper stuff here.
Well, that's what I was just going to say, is it touches on, so it's got some very interesting themes that I really did not recall him touching on, but it's because I read it so long ago, I think, and had such a different orientation when I was reading it.
Yeah,
I mean, because age is an obvious one, and but also I was really stunned to see how many times sin and choice and free will were brought up.
Yeah, and me too. One of one of my favorite scenes, which I'd like to read just a little bit of.
Yeah.
Is Will and Jim have seen things now that make them sure that they're looking at evil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, they run back home in the middle of the night. Jim doesn't have a father at home, but they live next door to each other. So they could see each other through the window. And so Jim goes home and Will goes home, but his dad's awake.
Mm-hmm.
So they start to talk. And, this to me, I just loved this little scene.
Mm-hmm.
Will says, "Dad, am I a good person?"
Oh, yes, I love this too.
And his dad says, "I think so. I know so, yes." Will that help things get really rough? Will that help when things get really rough? And his dad says, "It'll help." "Will it save me if I need saving? I mean, if I'm around bad people and there's no one else good around for miles, what then?" "It'll help." "That's not good enough, Dad. Good is no guarantee for your body. It's mainly for peace of mind. But sometimes, Dad, aren't you so scared that even the mind isn't peaceful?" His father nodded, his face uneasy. "Dad," said Will, his voice very faint, "are you a good person?" "To you and your mother, yes, I try, but no man's a hero to himself. I've lived with me for a lifetime. Will, I know everything worth knowing about myself. And adding it all up, the sum, as they come and go, I mostly sit very still and tight. Yes, I'm all right." "Then, Dad, why aren't you happy?" And then he goes on from there. You know, he says being good and being happy are not the same thing.
Well, and that was the thing that hit me is when he says, the father, just a couple sentences later, says, "Now look, since when did you think being good meant being happy?" And Will says, "Since always." And he says, "Well, since now learn otherwise, sometimes the man who looks happiest in town with the biggest smile is the one carrying the biggest load of sin. There are smiles and smiles. Learn to tell the dark variety from the light."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And then he talks about how men love sin and how you have to fight and fight and fight against giving into it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's just taking that piece of cake out of the fridge in the middle of the night.
Right. Yeah. And it was, you know, I was really struck by Will's wondering, hey, is being good enough, is going to take care of it? Because
mm-hmm.
he knows what he's up against. And that's what he's worried about. You know, this is all I have, you know, is that I'm good. He feels that he's good.
Well, and also because it's clearly set up that Jim Nightshade, he's the one with the darker impulses.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to start to get into spoiler territory here.
Mm-hmm.
So if you haven't read it, go read it.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the one that when they're just running around and they're kind of establishing character when they've, I don't think I ever realized this when I read the book before. This time I was like, oh, they're climbing a tree because they discovered a whorehouse nearby or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so they climb the tree and watch the couples. And Will doesn't want to do it. And Jim is really drawn to it. He's the one who wants to grow up early.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the main thing about Jim's character is he wants to grow up so bad.
Yeah.
You know, and... You know, I think that, you know, I've seen that in a lot of people where they're just not content at all with where they're at.
Right.
They want to be older, and when they're older, they want to be younger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just no dealing with today and contentness with what you've got. And Jim is like that. He's very unsettled.
Right. And then Will, who the blonde kid, who his name is Holloway, and when I was reading, I was like, oh, like hallowed.
Mm-hmm.
He's the good kid.
Right.
But he's also, I liked the thing about friendship it had at the beginning where it said, so there they go. Jim running slower to stay with Will. Will running faster to stay with Jim. Jim breaking two windows in a haunted house because Will's along. Will breaking one window instead of none because Jim's watching. God, how we get our fingers in each other's clay. That's friendship, each playing the potter to see what shapes we can make of the other.
Hmm.
And that's the effect they have on each other. Jim's a little bit better because Will's with him. Will's a little bit more daring and a little bit badder because of Jim. And it doesn't hurt either one of them necessarily because you have to kind of test those boundaries either way.
Right, yeah.
But it's that idea of Will is the kind of the center between the father and Jim, mm-hmm. the person who wants to be older, the person who wants to be younger, the real daring person, the person who's afraid to try. And Will's the fulcrum in the middle.
Yeah.
So it's, and for him to ask that question about being good and then the father to go on and talk about sin that way, I was really astounded.
Yeah, it was really, really pleasant to read. You know, and the whole book is like that. I mean, there's just, and the language is so, I mean, we've said that already, but man, I love it.
I just do.
You know, you sit there and you read it and it's a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think you get it more even in, it's really in the descriptive areas, and there's a lot to be descriptive of when he's talking about the carnival
mm-hmm.
and things like that than in the conversations like we've been reading. But I like that question of, since when did you think being good meant being happy?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that kind of goes to, that's, I think, a problem for a lot of people now, and especially with that gospel of prosperity.
Yeah,
that you hear about.
Yeah, that's a difficult one. Yeah.
Yeah, that idea that if you're good and follow all the rules, God will reward you with riches and that sort of thing. And I don't know exactly where that idea comes. Well, I know it comes from little pieces of scripture that have been pulled out of context, because it's like, have you read the Bible, people? Look at the people that are in here. They are not really necessarily always good. And when they're good, they're not always happy.
Yeah.
That's just not life.
That's just not how it works, right?
Yeah, it's unrealistic. And that's why it's a kid can think that.
Mm-hmm.
This is that turning point between childhood and adolescence and adulthood.
Yeah.
Where you have to learn that lesson.
Right. Yeah, and it was neat to see it laid out that way. Mm-hmm. In that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, there are, you know, a heck of a lot of people who believe that, but I mean, it's, you know, just one quick look around should prove to you, you know, in the adult world that's not the way it is. You know, we, I'm not trying to say, you know, point at people and say, well, they're sinful, you know, but
Mm-mm.
I know that there are a lot of rich folks out there that are pretty darn happy with themselves and probably have some thinking that they needed to be doing. You know,
yeah,
just from observation, you know,
mm-hmm.
And there are some poor folks, you know, there's a, you know, that have a lot of trouble that are just fine people. So
well, and it kind of depends on how you define happiness also.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But
that whole doctrine of the prosperity and, you know, if something's bad happening, we must be bad.
Oh yeah.
That's the thing that needs to. Yeah, it's obviously untrue.
Yeah, well, and certainly the Catholic Church doesn't buy into that at all, because mm-hmm. one of the things that I love about it is it recognizes that life is full of bad with the good. Mm-hmm. And so if you have suffering, you can offer it up to be used for good. It's not wasted,
mm-hmm.
which is, I guess, more complicated than I can really represent here mm-hmm. if people aren't familiar with that concept, but that idea that when you say, I am suffering through this, but Christ I want to unite this suffering to yours, please use it for something good. And you can give an intention or you can just say whatever you want, but mm-hmm. it gives a depth to the suffering. It's not for nothing. It's not meaningless.
Right.
And it's surprising. You can't all, most of the time you can't see what's happening with it. And I guess people could say it's a psychological device,
mm-hmm.
but, and certainly when I'm in the dentist chair, having a root canal done, yes, I'm grateful for whatever it is, you mm-hmm. know,
yeah.
that gives that more meaning. But I have seen amazing things happen for people who I specifically spent a long time offering up everything I could think of,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's a form of prayer too.
Yeah. I've never done that, but I ought to. I ought to look into that.
Yeah, it's just that uniting, asking Christ to unite your suffering to his on the cross.
Hmm.
And as his suffering was used for redemption, use your suffering also. Offer it up as something meaningful. It's a very powerful thing, both for you and for, you know, it's hard to remember to do it a lot of the time.
But gotcha. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fascinating, okay. Fascinating.
Yeah, did not expect to go there.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, okay. the year before my father died, especially, I was never happy about suffering because you never are.
Yeah.
But it was always, use this. If this will do any redemptive work for him, use it, you know.
Okay.
So it gave you an opportunity.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, let's talk about age a little bit, too.
Yeah.
Because age, you know, I think it has just a little bit more than just the fact that Jim wants to be older. I think Bradbury had some things to say about it. And again, you know, here we're talking about attitude. We touched on attitude there just a minute ago. But because Charles Holloway, it is an attitude thing that he's got.
yeah, you know, it permeates the book.
Yeah, he's 54 and he's sad. But he's fine, you know. He can't. It's not a physical issue. It's a mental issue. His sadness. It's not like he can't do these things with his kid. But he doesn't feel, you know, like in that sentence, you know, no man's a hero to himself. He feels, in my opinion, that he can't be that to his kid because he's just too darn old. And my kid's really never going to look up to me in that way.
He's kind of melancholy.
He really is. And I think that that's where it comes from, is he just feels that because of his age, he's done. And he'll never be this to his boy, Will. Right?
Right. And you kind of get this feeling, I thought maybe he had a heart condition or something, because he dwelt on it so much.
Yeah, he just dwelled on it so much. But then, you know, at the end of the book, once all this stuff has happened, his attitude has changed.
Yeah.
And he runs with the boys.
Well, and it's what you said earlier. No one's content to be where they are. They always want something else. And I know I remember saying something a long time ago to my mother-in-law along those lines for myself. And she just looked at me and said, "Be careful you don't wish your life away."
Yeah.
And I was like,
"Oh, that's yeah. I wish I had said something like that, you know, because when you say that, because I've said that to my kids, you know, it's just like you spend your entire year wishing you were somewhere else. You've lost your year. You've lost everything that's good out of this year." And I try to explain that to them, you know. And I try to do that myself, too, because, I mean, I get the same way. But the thing is, I've felt late my entire life, you know. Like, I got interested in football after high school. Okay, I can't play now, you know. And so it's just been that way, like, my entire life. And then when I look back on my college years, and what I did instead of taking advantage of the fact that I was in college. You know, I'm not saying I had bad times during these times. I had fine times, but I could, if I had been fully present, I would have got more out of my life at those two times.
Right.
You know, so I guess that's my point. But
well, and that's, I think, I hate to always bring everything back to American culture, but... It's kind of the, where are you going next? What are you going to do next? Let's multitask. Let's, you can have everything. Well, if you can have everything, then you never pick one thing. And you always feel bad about the stuff you didn't accomplish.
Yeah,
I think. And I struggle with it too sometimes. When I remember to do one thing at a time and just pay attention to what I'm doing, wow, the day is so much more satisfying.
Yeah, yeah, and for sure. And it is a... you know, and it, you know, you've got to admit that, you know, you've made choices in your life. And if you had made other choices, you'd probably be thinking, well, if I was, you know, doing what I'm thinking I wish I was doing right now, for example, if I had gone a different path and I was doing this other really cool thing that looks to me right now like it'd be way cool, and this is what I do for a living, you know, and if you had gone that way, you'd probably be thinking, well, you know, if I'd only gone that other route. Maybe
I hate
I'd
doing
be,
this cool
you
thing.
Know, yeah, maybe
yeah, my
because
life
it's
is
not
hollow.
As because the thing is, it you know, it nothing's as cool as you think it is once you're there. It's like you know when you know life is like climbing this mountain. Well, sometimes you get to the top and it's lonely because you've made it. You've hit your goal. And what are you going to do now? You know, you need another goal is what you need. But there's this plateau that if you spend your life on the plateau, you start to feel empty.
And that's when you realize that life is actually one giant mountain that never ends.
It's if you don't look at it that way, then you spend some lonely time because you're like, okay, I can't wait to do this. And you do it. And then you're like, and it's never everything that you wanted it to be.
Right.
It never is because you're always missing just a little bit.
Well, we have these standards of perfection. We know what perfection should be. And I tend to think that's part of what's built into us. It's kind of like a homing device.
Mm-hmm.
The only place we're ever really going to understand perfection and that we kind of instinctively want is in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But so everything we achieve here, it can be really great and fun. But yeah, it's like you're saying, it's never quite all.
It's never quite all. And only God is big enough to fill that.
Right.
That's the only thing. There's nothing else.
And if you'd have gone off and done that other cool stuff, would you have met your wife?
Yeah, exactly.
Have your kids, you know.
Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And you don't exactly know what Will's father is regretting other than he married late. And I don't know why he should regret marrying late, except I guess people fall into these patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Bradbury's talking about, because he should be happy he fell in love at all if it was late.
You know, I got to see Ray Bradbury, and I wish I'd pulled that out. I have actually Save the News article. It was a really cool thing for me. I was in college.
Yeah.
I went to the University of Arizona. And he, I guess, spent some time in Tucson as a kid.
Wow.
So anyway, I was going there, and I remember seeing this little poster. It says, Ray Bradbury. I was like, Ray Bradbury? Holy cow. So I went to his presentation, and it was cool. And I still remember a little bit about what he said. But one of the things was that he threw away his comic book collection at one point in his life, or gave it away, because he felt like he needed to be older. And once he did that, he became very, very sad. And then he realized, you know, forget about all these people that are telling me to be like everybody else. I'm going to do what makes me happy. So he started to collect comic books again, and it made him happy. He got to be himself. So it's not a comic book that made him happy. It's being himself that made him happy.
Yeah. Expressing himself in that way
exactly.
And enjoying that.
Yeah. And, you know, I can see that here in this book.
Yes.
And it's in here.
He says when he wrote it, there's a very short afterword in the edition I got from the library. He says that he was approaching middle age when he wrote it. And actually, he gives his progression of his association with carnivals through movies or through his mother taking him, all this stuff. And he actually met an illustrated man in a carnival who was actually a very nice person.
Uh-huh.
And then he was friends with Gene Kelly, and it's like, her?
Wow.
And his wife. And so they were he and his wife were over at their house one time, and he showed him part of a movie that has a carnival sequence in it. I wasn't familiar with the movie, but it left him so exhilarated, he went home and started, I think, what turned into this book. And it was meant as a screenplay for Gene Kelly to be in.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't. Somehow it just didn't, because Gene Kelly took it and went, okay, great, but they just couldn't make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wound up turning it into the book. So it's ironic that the movie came after the book, and too bad it wasn't that good, but because that's what it was intended for all along.
Yeah, yeah.
But the book is, obviously, if he's approaching middle age and he's had that kind of thinking, he was clearly making a big point.
Yeah.
It was a personal point.
Right, right.
And a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know if, I should have looked this up, but it seems to me that I had heard that Bradbury was not thrilled with the movie when it was finished. So, like I said, it's a swing and a miss. I mean, there are some really memorable stuff in there, but the book is just so much better. The deeper themes aren't discussed. You know, little part that I read about good and sin and everything like that, that you read too, that was really abbreviated in there because I was like, oh, they're really going to talk about it. And then they didn't. And I was like, oh, shoot, come on, guys.
Well, and you kind of need those deeper themes because otherwise it's a pretty shallow story. Because this is actually, this book is about a fight of good versus evil. Mm-hmm. Because the point that's made about the carnival is, there's speculation, but that's all we've got, so we have to go with it, is that everybody in that carnival was trapped by wanting to indulge longer than they should or more mm-hmm. than they should in something that is a sin.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Have we even mentioned that the carousel makes you older? Or
no,
younger?
We hadn't gotten to that because we hadn't hit the spoiler. Please do tell. Go ahead.
But yeah, that's what the carousel does. If you run it backwards, you get younger. If you run it forwards, you get older.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim, once he witnesses this, of course, wants to get on that thing and get older because that's what he wants more than anything.
Right.
And Will is doing everything he can to prevent it because he knows that it's harmful.
Right.
He doesn't really say why it's harmful, but he's like, this is not, he just knows this is not good for you to have
that.
That's
not how it should be.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing too. You know, I mean, he sacrifices a lot to help Jim not do that, which is an interesting thing in today's society too, because I mean, so many of us just allow, without any words whatsoever, allow people to do things that are destructive. When we don't always step in when we ought to. But here, Will is like, I know you want this super bad, and I know we're best friends, but I'm not going to let you do that. And, he goes to the extreme to not allow that.
Yeah, it's not right.
It's
somehow.
Not right. Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, another fascinating part to me was they're at the carousel. Jim gets on the carousel. This is the end. Will jumps on there. So he's actually getting older with Jim for a half a revolution anyway,
mm-hmm.
and manages to pull Jim off of there. And Jim appears to have died. And as they're dealing with that, this kid comes up to Mr. Holloway and says, I think he says something like, I know where Mr. Dark is or something, or come this way. I need to, something like that.
Oh, that's right.
But it turns out that the little boy is Mr. Dark.
Right.
And the way that Holloway defeats Mr. Dark is with love.
Yes.
He says, well, I know who you are now. And all I'm going to do, I'm just going to hug you and care about you. And I'm going to be good to you. And you're not going to be able to stand it. And sure enough, that's what happens.
Yeah, because the Dust Witch, he kills her, and it's because he put a smile on a bullet.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when they're bringing Jim back to life or back from the brink of death,
mm-hmm.
it's laughter that does it and joy.
Right.
And so smiling, laughter, joy, and love are all equated as being part of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of interesting to me because I was just reading a book called Between Heaven and Mirth by mm-hmm. James Martin.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
By James Martin, as in
the Jesuit,
My Life with the Saints? Yeah,
that great. Guy. It's mm-hmm. a great book. Mm-hmm. And it's called Why Joy, Humor, and Laughter Are at the Heart of the Spiritual Life.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, and so I was, in fact, I was going to write a review of it.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming by my blog for a blog tour next week, and
fun.
I had to have Tom bring the book home because I was going to write it at work. But it says, he says, why are we naturally drawn to joyful people? One reason, I believe, is that joy is a sign of God's presence, which is naturally attractive. God's joy speaks to the joy that dwells sometimes hidden in our hearts. Hmm. We are drawn to joy because we are drawn to God. We naturally desire God, the source of all joy. And he says that's fundamental.
How about that?
I looked at this and I was like, that's exactly what Bradbury's saying. I mean, he doesn't have the God element in there, but that's how do you fight evil. That's the ultimate good.
Yeah. And I have no clue if Ray Bradbury is religious in any way, no idea at all, but it certainly seems to permeate this book. You know, there's no flat out statement that about God in any way.
Mm-mm.
But it certainly seems to permeate Will's character and how he's concerned about good and how his dad talks about sin. And
well, I think the fact that the word sin is used, mm-hmm. and he would always kind of say, or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. because he's leaving it open to anyone who wants to be drawn into this story, mm-hmm. which is fine with me. But he used the word sin an awful lot, and that's a word that usually, and I'm not saying he's Christian or whatever, but I mean, that's a word that we all understand. There's sin and there's good.
Mm-hmm.
And sin is just, you know, I mean, that's a point that's made when they're talking about the carnival and speculating about the people who were drawn into it and how it was done. And we saw Mr. Dark trying to do it to Jim. He's like, well, Mr. Cougar's dead. I need another partner. You could be that partner. Just put you up a few years. You'd be in your 20s. You'd be a great partner. Go see the country with me running this carnival. But Will's father speculates because Miss Foley gets caught. He says, and Will says, oh, poor Miss Foley, they got her now, just like you say. Once she got what she wanted, it scared her. She didn't like it. She was crying so hard, Dad. I bet they'll promise her someday she can be 50 again if she'll mind. And so it shows that regret. You've got it, and you're really sorry. And he kind of speculates. He goes, well, Will's father says they've probably thrown her in with the freaks.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, and what are they? Sinners who've traveled for so long hoping for deliverance. They've taken on the shape of their original sins. The fat man, what was he once? If I can guess the carnival's sense of irony, the way they like to weight the scales, he was once a ravener after all kinds and varieties of lust. There he lives now, anyway, collected up in his bursting skin. The thin man, skeleton or whatever, did he starve his wife's children's spiritual as well as physical hungers? And he goes on and speculates about others. But it was interesting to me that Bradbury was saying, you kind of become what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, which is the whole idea of in the, it's funny. I just went to confession yesterday because here we are again at confession. But and the priest gave me a little advice, and he said, well, I think what you want to do is try to practice harder the moral virtues, you know, which are fortitude. Now I can't remember the others. One of them is patience, but there's a different word for it or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, but he was like, you know, because the more you practice those things, the more they become a part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And they help you deal with these other issues.
Right.
And so if you're not practicing those, you know, if you're practicing the bad things, you kind of become that way too. And I thought it was interesting that that kind of went together with what Bradbury was saying about here we can see the outside manifestation of their inner problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dark, he's illustrated. Is he all those things?
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's the originator of the carnival.
Right. Yep. Yeah, it's very good. Very good.
Mm-hmm. So, and then, because there's this whole thing at the end about evil has only the power we give it.
Yeah, and that was a cool thing, too. Once he stopped, he was in the mirror thing, the mirror maze.
Yeah, this is Holloway's father. That was crazy.
Yeah, and people would come out of there, you know, really shaken up. But Mr. Holloway, all he did was when he stopped believing what he was seeing, it mm-hmm. lost all its power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was an interesting statement as well.
And I think that's also, at some point, he said, evil has only the power we give it. And he's saying, so I take it all back. I starve you. I won't give you anything to work with. Mm-hmm. I refuse to cooperate, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And that stopped it.
And it did, yeah.
And I just thought, well, that's such a true statement because he talks about our potential for evil, even though he's talking about it in terms of skipping a class or taking that piece of cake and how hard it is to fight that small thing. And then he's saying, if we don't give it that power, if we turn away from it, then we don't feed our own potential for evil.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just an amazing book. I mean, because it's a great story, too.
Right, right.
You're on tenterhooks the whole time. The carnival is seeking them all over town, and the father is lying for them, having to stand up against the illustrated man, taunting him with his own fears of heart attacks and things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it kind of made me, and I, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just, Yeah, I've got another movie I wanted to talk about, but go ahead. Yeah.
Do you wanna,
okay. There's a movie called The Halloween Tree. Have you ever seen that?
I have, but on your recommendation.
Oh, did you like it?
About a year ago, I think, and now I'm trying to remember.
It was, it's animated, and the animation's not fantastic, but it's such a good adaptation of Bradbury because it really captures his feel. I think better than the Something Wicked This Way Comes movie, myself.
Yeah.
But in that movie, you've got four kids on Halloween. They're getting ready to go out trick-or-treating, and the three kids go to the fourth kid's house, and the fourth kid can't come out because he's very, very sick.
Right.
So what ends up happening is that the fourth kid is on his deathbed, and he's kind of the leader of the group. He's the best boy. He runs faster. He just does all these boy things better than any other boy.
He's a natural leader.
Exactly. Yeah. So they see his spirit basically come out of the house, and they start to chase it to try and bring it back. And, you know, although they don't realize that's exactly what they're doing. And then they end up going to this house where, and I can't remember the name of the fella either. It was voiced by Leonard Nimoy.
Oh.
And again, the animation is not terrific, but the story is just fantastic. And they end up going to all these times, back to Mexico,
right,
where they had the
Day of the Dead.
The Day of the Dead and Aztecs and Egypt. You know, they go to all these places.
Yeah. Mummies.
And get everything that they need to put their friend all back together. And anyway, I thought it was a terrific movie. I really love it.
Well, it's like The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. The animated one with Boris Karloff doing the voice, not the newer one, which is dreadful. Avoid it at all costs.
You're
it is
a mean one, Mr.
Yes.
Grinch.
Yep. Oh, you do that quite well.
When I have a cold, I get even better.
Aren't we lucky then? But yeah, the animation doesn't have to be stellar for the movie itself to make the point.
Yeah, it sure doesn't.
And be creative. And Bradbury says himself he just loves Halloween.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely his holiday. I swear, when October comes around, I think Bradbury. And for the last several years, I've always tried to read some Bradbury in October.
I know.
Yeah.
And now I think about it, and I'm just going, you know, the only book of his I've read recently at all is The Martian Chronicles. And that's actually because SFF Audio gave me him reading The Martian Chronicles, I think.
Okay.
And him commenting on them. And I reviewed it a while back, I believe. And I was thinking about The Illustrated Man and Fahrenheit 451, all these books that we say we know so well. And I thought, I bet I don't know them half as well as I think. I need to reread them.
Yeah, it's been so long. I'm just trying to remember. I have a short story collection that I read last year that I just loved.
What was it?
That's what I'm trying to remember.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure the first story in it was called The Dwarf. Let's see. The Dwarf, Bradbury. Let's see if I get lucky here. I won't spend too much time, but see, Ray Bradbury, The Dwarf.
Well, you can look and
The October Country, of course.
Oh, well, duh. Okay,
right.
I was thinking there's so many titles now I can't think of any of them, and he's such a talented short storyteller.
Right. But that is a fantastic short story collection,
The
October Country. Really great.
I have a collection, but I got from the library collection. I think it's called October. Maybe it's just called October Ween or something. Anyway, it's from a few years ago, and it's a short story collection of all Halloween stories, an anthology. But it also has, in between, Halloween recollections from various authors, including Ray Bradbury. And I think that's where I read, and he was just like, I always loved it above all holidays. But what he loved was the old manifestation that you and I were talking about, that innocent joy of, you know, flirting with the scary, but it's not really.
And there's no other holiday. I mean, Christmas has a wonderful feel to it, right?
Oh, yes.
And then But Halloween is the only other holiday that I can associate a specific feeling with.
Right.
You know, Thanksgiving is wonderful. I enjoy that, but it's like a big party, you know.
Yeah, it's not the same
it's
thing.
It's not
a family
specific
get-together.
Feeling, yeah. But Halloween has a specific feel, and Christmas has a specific feel. And it came from my growing up, I think, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I look forward to them both.
The time of year. And plus, fall is my favorite time of year.
Yeah, mine too.
Mm-hmm. And for so many people, I think it is. Well, for our family, because I know it got really breezy and windy a few weeks ago, and Hannah went, fall is almost here. I can feel it. It's my favorite time of year. And I was like, I know.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
But this also makes me think, and I'd mentioned this before, if you don't mind if I bring it up, of the fact that it's a troubling trend to me that so many Christians and surprising number of Catholics are afraid of Halloween. They, you know, they don't want to let their kids go trick-or-treating. They fear it's inviting the devil. They won't let them dress up, or if they dress up, it has to be a saint's or something.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, and they make them go to these, you know, it's kind of like in line with the schools where it's like, let's have a harvest celebration and you can get candy. And you're just like, oh, what? No fun at all.
Yeah.
But, and of course I don't agree with that, but and it surprises me because like I was mentioning this to a friend of mine who's a deacon at our church and he's like, well, I don't think that's all wrong. And I was like, oh, wait, you used to be Church of Christ. And I'm not saying anything against, I don't know, but I'm just saying, oh, I wonder if that's that Protestant kind of carryover of thinking.
Because
the church has no feeling on this one way or the other. But it made me think of something wonderful that Peter Laws said in Flicks That Church Forgot. I don't know if you ever listened to that.
I have heard it before.
Maybe the last time. I can't remember. He basically reviews horror films. He just loves them. But he always is very thoughtful, and he will then stop and say, okay, now, from a theological Christian point of view, and he's a Baptist minister in England.
Mm-hmm.
And he's great because he never, ever puts down any other way that people are choosing to try to find truth. But he always says, I was an atheist. This is the right way. And here's what this movie reflects, kind of like we do, but more pointed, that we can see. And last year, he did a 3-part series about Halloween.
Oh.
And the way Christians are afraid of it and react sometimes. And he kind of refuted some of the thinking. But one of the things he said, do you mind if I read this?
Oh, please do.
He says, we can give the spiritual world of evil too much power. I guess it's a case of either the devil isn't real or the devil is on every street corner inside a pumpkin. Surely there is a middle ground where we can acknowledge supernatural evil, but we recognize its limited power in the face of the power of Christ. Ironically, I wonder if this might have been some of what the Christians were doing when they celebrated All Hallows' Eve and All Saints' Day in the past, and he's talking about the origins of it. Those festivities were opportunities to laugh in the face of evil spirits, to dress up as them and sort of mock them, saying, hey, check this out. These big scary demons, they're just empty masks. When you compare them with the power of the risen Jesus Christ, they're not up to much. I wonder if Halloween offers us a chance to affirm our eternal life while looking into the face of death, which actually has lost its sting. For Christians, the scariness of death is not scary, not really, because we've got eternal life.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that's it. I think that's what confuses me so much, because I was like, why are you, it's what Ray Bradbury says, why are you giving this power to evil? Christ has defeated it. The king of this world is the king of the next world is Christ. And he says, I have defeated this, or, you know, I have overcome this world.
Yeah.
Where the devil can walk. So, you know, laugh at it. You can mock it in the name of Christ as your savior.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, and he can't do anything anyway, other than, you know, influence you or try to nudge you in a direction that's not good.
Right, right.
Yeah,
so, that's great.
Yeah, and that's really what Bradbury is saying the whole way here. I mean, he might refute the words it's said in, or I don't know if he's Christian, but that's essentially what a great story with this underlying thing in it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because at the end of the story, it's the wonderful thing. They all look at the carousel. Mr. Dark is defeated. He's gone. He's dead. And they think, just 3 times ahead, just 4 times ahead, just 10 times back. And that's the father. And they each read the thoughts in the other one's eyes and are like, how easy, just once. But once you start, you'd come back again and again, and then you'd offer rides to friends and more friends, and then you're Mr. Dark.
That's right.
And so they knock it down, and they run a race back home. and the father runs with them and slaps the post with them.
Right, right, exactly.
Not worrying about if he gets a pain in his chest or not.
That is right.
Yeah.
Yep, wow.
Which is what we have to do, I guess. Resist it, remember where it takes us, and then run that race and laugh and be joyful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, if you didn't mean all that, it's kind of an amazing thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is something. Yeah. Because, it's all in there.
It's a whole theology in this tiny little book, just because, and like, I guess the James Martin book said, this is a fundamental thing of Christianity. If you happen to be listening to this and you're not a Christian, it's still a thing that I think we can all recognize. Mm-hmm. There's good and there's bad. You fight for good and you resist bad.
Yeah.
Of course, you have more meaning and power and everything because if you're Christian and Catholic, especially, mm-hmm. I would say, as Catholic, because it's what's the ultimate reality.
Right.
That you can see more clearly what you're doing.
Yeah.
And define lines, I think.
Right, right.
So.
Yep.
I had to say that, everyone.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So all now right. Let's see. We had a good iTunes. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we done?
No, I think we are. Go ahead.
I'm just moving on.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I didn't mean to rest control.
No, rest control.
Was it Mama Nerd? Was that her name?
Mama Nerd, yes.
Thank you, Mama Nerd.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
For our iTunes review. That was really fun to read.
That was cool. Yep, very nice. Appreciate that very much.
Yes. Yep. Oh, and Will Duquette, from A View from the Foothills, he wrote something about after listening to the podcast on Declare.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And he had something to say about The Great Game, which was, remember we talked about that in that. And so I'll just read this if you don't mind.
Okay, please do. Mm-hmm.
He says, a word about The Great Game. Properly speaking, The Great Game was the conflict between Russia and Great Britain for control of Central Asia during the 19th and early 20th centuries. Russia wanted warm water ports and would gladly take India away from Great Britain. And of course, Britain didn't want that. The whole thing was contingent on spying out the other side's activities, but even more on spying out the lands of Central Asia. You can't invade or stop an invasion if you don't know the terrain and how to safely get to where you want to go. It was dangerous country and little known to either side at first, and much of the spying out was done on the British side by men who disguised themselves as natives and traveled the land all alone. They were delightfully known as pundits and were said to be playing the great game. The best book on the subject that I'm aware of is Peter Hopkirk's The Great Game, which is one of those books I keep telling people about. And, of course, that makes me think of Kim by Rudyard Kipling, which I haven't read. I've read part of it. I've tried to start it several times.
Well, in Declare, it feels like we've read most of Kim. he quoted it so often at the beginning of the chapters. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great.
I thought that was...
The Great Game. I'm definitely putting that on my list. That interests me very much.
Oh, yes. Yep. Then you can tell me all about it. Great. Okay. Then I don't have to read it.
All right. We'll do. Yeah, that'll be fun.
Let's see. Did we have anything else?
No, not that I'm aware of.
No, me either.
Next time we'll talk about The Social Network.
Yeah.
Talk about some how we all connect.
Mm-hmm.
And then November 17th is The Way Station by Clifford D. Simak.
Oh, yes.
And then we're into December.
Yeah. Yes. And
December 1st is Tokyo Godfathers.
Oh, yeah. I was just talking with Rose about that last night because she was looking at my list of movies for this podcast.
Yeah.
And we were talking about other movies versus that one. And she was like, yeah, but that's so unusual to have a Japanese movie that treats those subjects like that. So I'm really looking forward to
talking about it. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing
Christmas
that.
Christmas and things like that.
And then Terry Pratchett for December 15th, Hogfather.
Yeah, keeping it light.
Which is cool. That'll be fun. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we're off for the holidays. Yay! And assuming 2012 does come.
Mayans notwithstanding. I'm just going to say, they just started their calendar over then, everybody, just so you know.
Oh, that's good.
I know
everybody
who listens to this knows that, but I just had to say it anyway.
That's right. That's right. So we'll be off for the holidays. We'll be back on January 12th after that is what we decided. So,
but you do have apocalyptic plans.
Oh, I do have apocalyptic plans. Right? If it does happen, we're going to stop doing the podcast and then start a new one called A Good Zombie Is Hard to Find, which will be aimed straight at the undead only. I think it's a moneymaker, because that's...
I think it would be a moneymaker now, actually, but...
That's right.
We'd have to be ready to change it for the next supernatural thing that's the trend.
I wonder if they're horrified by regular people books. So we should read things like East of Eden, and it would be horrifying for them.
Oh, obviously. Well, and speaking of, since this was Halloween, I can highly recommend the drink, the zombie,
ooh,
which we had for the first time last weekend.
Really? What's in that?
It is pineapple juice, orange juice, not a lot of any, but passion fruit juice, which I'd never tasted. And it's like a cross between mango, pineapple, and orange, and some lemon and lime juice, and then three ounces of rum, and it's gold, white, and 151 proof rum.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And when Rose was buying the rum, she was looking for the passion fruit syrup, actually, and she was looking at the 151 proof rum, and two different guys who worked at the store went by it and were like, are you sure you want that, young lady? Because she's 21. Like, you're not wanting to burn the house down, right? Don't light this on fire. And she's like, yes, all over the bottle, the inflammable.
Oh, my goodness.
Signs. And so, but we watched it during the we drank them during the Cowboys game, and we needed them, believe me.
that's terrific.
And went into a zombie, sad zombie.
Oh, wow. That's great. Well, I will make myself a zombie.
They were delicious. Mm-hmm. They were. In fact, I have the recipe that will go up today on my cooking blog.
Oh, neat.
So we can put a link. But okay, they were like the best fruit punch I've ever had. I'm not crazy about fruit punch, but that was good.
Oh, nice. Well, that's great.
Just one. I could only have one.
Sounds good. All right. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see you folks next time.
I guess that's it. Have a good Halloween, and only have one zombie if you have them.
That's right.
If you have two or three, remember, I said just one.
And for goodness sake, go trick-or-treating.
Yes, go trick-or-treating, and if you see any carnivals, don't go at night.
Don't go there. Not at 3 in the morning.
No. Yeah, that's right. Oh, can I say one thing about 3 in the morning?
Yeah.
That occurred to me, and sorry, and we lost it, but... That 3 in the morning, I've always had Catholic friends say, if you wake up and it's 3 in the morning and somebody comes to mind, you're supposed to be saying a prayer for them.
Oh, really?
And I've always thought, that's the oddest thing. But then I've noticed how often I've wakened up at 3 in the morning with someone on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any, miraculous stories. But it occurs to me, I wonder if that's because Christ supposedly died at 3 in the afternoon.
Mm.
And it's the opposite, when the witching hour would be the greatest. I don't know. I just suddenly thought of that and went, good versus evil, 12 hours after.
Wow.
So I'm just going to throw that out there as a little trick-or-treat into your bags.
All right.
You guys could think about that. Maybe somebody will have some good feedback on it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, sorry.
All right. No, great. All right, have a good couple weeks, everybody.
Happy Halloween, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.